The Thursday interview
on The Hard Shoulder.
Thanks to Australia's McGuigan Wines, four-time IWSC International Winemaker of the Year. This time, bring a McGuigan.
It's a great pleasure to welcome for our Thursday interview someone who's been a regular guest, in fact, someone who's made a living out of having a heart condition. I've never seen someone to turn it to their advantage. I'm referring to one of the best known voices of sports broadcasting, the voices of the GAA, and for such a long year, 34 years, I think, was the presenter of the Sunday game. I'm referring, of course, to my Thursday interview guest, Michael Lister. You're most welcome to the program. How is your health at the present time?
My health, Ivan, is very, very good. 35 years, by the way. I was at it even longer than I thought. And I can tell you, I can't honestly say to you that I've turned the heart condition into any advantage to myself. But I hope that over the last couple of years, I've been trying to turn it into other people's advantage for our work with the Irish Heart Foundation and stuff like that. But look, generally, I'm in good form. I actually met there about an hour ago down the local park. I was out for a walk. A lad that I used to work with in RTE, who retired from RTE about 20 years ago after a serious heart problem as well. And, well, he's still walking around Kilboggart Park anyway, like myself, so it's all good.
And you know when they say, when they're doing the kind of obituaries in the HSE for the COVID thing, they say that so-and-so had an underlying condition. Is a heart condition one of those underlying conditions?
Not only, Ivan, an underlying condition, it's one of the prime conditions.
Oh?
Because outside of the COVID-19 scenario altogether, at the beginning of the winter every year, I am encouraged by my heart specialist to make sure, as I did this year, or at least at the end of last year, get the flu jab. Because anything like just the ordinary flu for somebody with the heart condition is a risk factor. So obviously something like this particular thing is a higher level again. So yeah, it's very much part
of it. Why is that? Is that it could turn into pneumonia or what?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I'm not a medical expert and I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I do know that if your heart isn't operating to full function, as mine most definitely is not, then you're more vulnerable. In other words, it's very simple, Ivan. You're less able to fight the problem than a person who would be a lot healthier than me, or I guess a lot younger as well.
Well, I better hurry up and get on with your life story if you're not snuffed it by seven. All right, Michael, let's go back to the beginning, because everyone considers you to be a Galway person, but you're actually from the Daisha, are you?
I'll give you an Irish answer to that, yes and no. I will tell you, if anybody asks me where I'm from, it's Galway, and which of course in itself is a bit of a joke because I've actually lived in Dublin longer than I lived in Galway. But I was actually born, you're right, I was born in Waterford, I was born in Dungarvan. And the circumstances was my father, Martin, was a guard. My mother was a Waterford woman. She was an Irish dancing teacher. And I was born in Dungarvan. But shortly afterwards, I can't remember exactly, I think I was about 3 years old, they moved to Galway because his father had died, Michael Lester as well, in fact, my grandfather, and he got a dispensation to go back to Galway to be close to his mother, who was now living alone and all that kind of stuff. So even though I was born in Waterford, by going to Galway, part of the story is I was going back to Galway, even though that's not where I was born.
And being the son of a guard, what was that like growing up in so far as, guard, there is a culture of being a Garda and an identity, and they're never off duty in a way. Did you ever notice that?
Oh, yeah, totally, absolutely. Being the son of a guard in a small community, and we lived, and he was a guard in a place called Barnadjarrig, which is about 7 miles from Tuam. So we're talking here the classic rural community. These were in days when the local rural community actually did have guards in them. And
was it the days before Gardaí had Nixers?
I think they probably had them then as well. But anyway, so he was like, Martin Lester was like the local sheriff in the area. And like any good guard in a local community like that, he knew everything about everybody. And he knew them because that's where he came from himself. In actual fact, let me give you another little part of the story. The station that in Barnadjarrig that he was assigned to was where he grew up himself and where the Lesters were actually from. which was very unusual to get actually stay, and still is, by the way, to get stationed back to your own area, to your own village. In actual fact, it was an unheard of thing. But like all good things in Ireland back in the 50s, a few strokes were pulled and involved an archbishop as well, who was a cousin of his, and the right calls were made to the right people, and it was made to happen. So the Leicesters were part of the community.
They're well connected, yeah.
Yeah, well connected. And then the fact that he was the local guard, there was a status or a respect, I suppose, to put it more simply.
Were there any downsides to it, though, insofar as that, oh, don't tell him because, or you know, or things that you knew about that maybe you'd be better off not knowing about?
Let me put it to you this way. He was very good at handling situations, and I know what you mean. There were awkward things, as there would be in any community with issues with locals and all that kind of stuff. He had a way of handling it with people on a one-to-one basis, and there was always the threat, if things were not working out to his satisfaction, there was always the threat, because the guards in Tuam were only 7 miles away, and it was kind of, the ultimatum would be, hey, listen, if you don't get this sorted, I'm going to get the guards in Tuam out here on this one, you know. And I heard that a few times. This used to happen on a reasonably regular basis for a short period of time, for a couple of years, and there were decent people, but if there was a few drinks taken, there was trouble. And the number of nights at about 2 o'clock in the morning, you would get this banging at the door, guard, guard, come over. And he would do that very thing that I'm talking about. He would say, I'll be over there in 10 minutes. I'm going to ring Tuam and I'm going to set them to sort out the squad car. And I'll tell you, if trouble hasn't settled down over there, you're all in the jail. And then he would go back to bed. And he'd get up maybe about an hour later, and then he'd go over, he'd saunter over to see. And of course, by the time he went over, everything was wonderful. Nobody was any problem to anybody, and the whole thing would be sorted out.
You went to school, you did your Leaving Cert in Tuam, was it?
I went to St. Jarrett's in Tuam, yeah, and that's where I did the Leaving Cert.
And what type of pupil were you? Were you a bit of a class swat, or were you as easygoing as you now are?
Yeah, I was one of those people, Ivan. I just stayed under the radar. I didn't dislike school, but I didn't particularly like it either. And I did what I had to do to get by. I suppose if I was to in any way clap myself on the back, I was intelligent enough to get away with it without having to push things too far.
I mean, you're cute enough. And did you have any career objective? Like, is there anything you wanted to be?
Not anything sensible or logical. I had one time a great notion to be a RAF Air Force pilot. But I don't think back in the 1970s there was too many calls for anybody from Ireland to join the RAF.
But were you fascinated by aviation?
I was fascinated by aeroplanes and all that. By the way, can I just say quite simply, I certainly was not intelligent enough to be a pilot anyway to begin with, whether it was in the RAF or anywhere else. But
first job then? I mean, like, what was your career plan?
Yeah, my life path, if you like, should have taken me on a very different course. Because, again, I was talking to you there a minute ago about those family connections and all that kind of stuff. A cousin of mine was in the sugar factory business, the Irish beet business.
In Tuam, yeah.
He wasn't in Tuam. He was manager of a different plant. But, so, again, I had connections. I had sugar factory connections. And
look, it's who you know rather than what you know in Tuam. I know this. I know
that's still the case, but as you know very well, that was far more prevalent back in the day as it is now, although it is still very alive and well in Ireland at the moment as well. But anyway, after I left school and after I left St. Jarrett's, I got a job in the sugar factory in Tuam. It was a temporary job, but there was no doubt that the opportunity was going to be there to make this a permanent fixture going forward. And that looked like, I mean, there was a lot of sense to this. It was actually well-paying. It was in or Tuam, or I just came, as I said, from outside Tuam. So it was all good. I mean, that was fine. And while this process was going on, I saw an ad in the Tuam Herald newspaper looking for a young reporter to join the staff. And I applied for it. I was always, my favourite subject in school would always have been English and history as well. But the English side of it, and I used to write articles for the college magazine and all that kind of stuff. So I was interested in writing. And I applied for the job, and I got the job. And I got it quite simply because the editor, Jared Burke, reckoned I was local and I knew things that some people who were showing up with journalistic degrees from the other side of the country wouldn't have the local knowledge of and all that kind of thing. And again, the Garda connection, he knew that was part of my...
But you ended up writing a music column in the Tuam Herald. What was your favourite music? What were you into?
To put the music column in context, I did, as any reporter in a provincial newspaper would do, I did everything. I did the court cases, I did the county council meeting, I did Galway Corporation when Michael D. Higgins was an alderman back in the day, and a very far-seeing one.
Was it Gary Glitter? Was it Jimmy Savile? Who are you into in terms of music?
Yeah, right. Let me go back to what I was talking about. So I did all of these things, and of course sport, obviously. But while I was there, myself and Tom Gilmer, who was another chap that worked in the Tuam Herald, we decided to set up a music column. And we split the music very simply. Tom was a big country and western fan. He featured during the week, actually, in Clonacarn on RTE on the Big Tom special. It was on the other night. And he wrote the Big Tom book that came out there about a year ago or 18 months ago. So he handled the country and western, and I handled the rock because that was my specialty. And in the early 70s, when we started this column, it was David Bowie, it was Led Zeppelin, it was Deep Purple, Pink Floyd, any of those guys. That was my type of music. I can tell you, Ivan, for an absolute fact, I was the only guy in the parish of Killarney in Galway that owned a Led Zeppelin album, or anything even close to it. I think the nearest thing was John Fleming down the road, who had a couple of Elvis.
So you records. Were quite cool.
I suppose maybe it came from my mother's side, because, as I said, she was an Irish dancing teacher. So maybe that little touch of music was in the
so,
blood.
So let's fast forward then to starting in RTE reading your first sports bulletin. I heard you were a bit offhand in relation to applying for it and so on, but when did it start as such?
I was totally offhand. It was in 1979 that RTE advertised. They were after setting up Radio 2, 2FM as it is now, obviously, and they were looking for people to man the daily sports bulletins. And again, a little bit like the Tuam Herald ad that I saw when I was in the sugar factory, I saw this ad in the Irish Independent looking for broadcasters, sports broadcasters, to join the panel. I had absolutely no intention of going to RTE, but I did have an intention of going up to RTE to have a look around. So I applied for the job, and I got called for an interview, and then I got called back, and then there was a voice test and all this thing, and this was all great crack. And I did actually bump into Gay Byrne one day, and this was the whole purpose of the exercise, to have a snoop around Donnybrook and the national broadcaster and all that kind of thing. And then they offered me the job, and I didn't actually respond to the letter, because this wasn't in the plan. This was all great crack up to that point. And I can't. A couple of weeks passed by.
Taking on the job have meant for the first time uprooting yourself from Tuam and moving to Dublin?
Oh, everything. I mean, yeah I was nicely settled in the West. Yeah. I was totally happy there, and I had no need to go to Dublin. I didn't. It was usual crack. I didn't need this move. But anyway, the point is, they wrote to me a second time. There was no emails in those days, and the gist of the letter was, we don't really give a hoot whether you're coming or not, but would it at least give us an answer so we know what to do next? And it's one of those things, Ivan, you're sat there and you're saying to yourself, what do I do here?
And well, you first of all check the salary.
No, the salary was fine. There was no problem with that. I checked that, all right. That was about 10 times more than I was getting paid in the Tuam Herald.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things where in life, sometimes you have to go with just a gut instinct about something. Doesn't have to be a clear...
Well, what age were you? What age were you when you took the leap?
I was 25. I joined RTE in December 1979. So I was 25 at that stage.
And one of the things, Michael, just listening to you, is, and my Thursday interview guest is Michael Lister, the GAA Sunday game legend and much more, is that you actually don't have an accent, and you have a kind of very kind of mild voice. Like, you know, it's clear you are a Culchie, but you don't come across as a Culchie.
I suppose that's probably from growing up in a house where I was born, as you said, in Waterford. I grew up in Galway. My mother was a Waterford woman with a Waterford accent, and my father was obviously from Galway and all that. So I think I just didn't acquire a strong accent or whatever. I think it was as simple as that, you know.
And so therefore, it was reading sports bulletins was your daily diet of work.
That was it. not doing, and as you know, they're still there on 2FM, the daily bulletins, or whether or not they're at the moment, obviously, because there's no sport to talk about. But apart from that, and that was my first shot at it, was doing radio stuff. And
did you do match reports then?
Yeah, I would have been out and about on weekends when you weren't doing the bulletins in studio. You're off away doing the various matches. And I did an awful lot of rugby back in the day. I did all this stuff, soccer and GA and all the rest of it. But they kind of attached me to the rugby side of things in the early days. And in actual fact, in 1983, I think it was, I went on the Lions tour to New Zealand that year, the team that had all that Irish team that were famous.
And that was Mick Doyle's Triple Crown winning team, all that, and Michael Kiernan and those type
guys,
of... And you did interviews with them and so on. So was the world your oyster? Were you content? Or how did the Sunday game come around in the 80s?
That just became... But the world was my oyster from the point of view that as much as I enjoyed working at the Tuam Herald, as much as I enjoyed life in Galway, rural life in Galway, when you get to the national broadcaster and things like that, going on a Lions tour or interviewing the top sports people of the day. I interviewed Nicky Lauda on one occasion. He was over on a tour to Ireland when he was world champion. And, you know, you're meeting that calibre.
You're a fierce man
people.
For the name drop.
So, yeah, this is a no-brainer if you're into sport, doing all this.
Yeah. So you were living the dream. You were loving the job. But what happened to do... Michael, how would you feel about presenting? Was the Sunday game only starting then? Were they looking for a new presenter? Was Micheál O'Herty or Michael O'Hare? Was this genre there? Like, I can't just pinpoint the start of this and how they get a young fella who was, you know, a bit more than a cub reporter, but not a Bill O'Herlihy or someone to front this. Like, that was a big break.
It was. The Sunday game at this stage, this is 1984, the Sunday game was on the air for 5 years at this stage. It was coming into its fifth year. And there had been a number of presenters of it before that. And one of them, incidentally, was Jim Carney from Tuam. And Jim had worked in the Tuam Herald. And I replaced Jim Carney in the Tuam Herald. But Jim had a serious car accident. And he was off the scene for a little while as a result of that. And Jim, in actual fact, eventually left RTE, left Dublin, and went back to work in the Tuam Herald. And all the, so there was that kind of musical chairs before I arrived. Sean O'Callaghan presented the programme for a year as well. But they were clearly looking for somebody going forward to fill the chair. And there was no permanent, because it was only on the air for, as I said, at that stage, 4 years or something like that. And there was two or three presenters already of it. And the Sunday game then wasn't the big animal that it is now in the public perception of the programme. So anyway, I'm over in the sports office, radio sport and television sport in RTE back in those days in the 80s were in separate parts of the complex. They're together now. But I got a phone call one day, and this guy, Maurice Reedy, in actual fact, who happened to be the editor of the Sunday game, he said to me, did you ever fancy doing any television work? This now was, I think, around February or something like that. And I said, well, sure, yeah, Maurice, I mean, I wouldn't say no. And he said, so you'd fancy doing something on a programme? I said, yeah, I suppose if the opportunity came up. And he said, okay. And he says, how are you fixed on Sunday? And this, I think, was a Thursday.
They're obviously desperate for some fill-in or something.
The Sunday night sports programme, which Fred Cogley presented.
Yes.
And I said, and I've always said this about it in the past, the first thought that came into my head is, as a young single man living in a rented house in Dublin with two other lunatics, my first thought was, do I have a clean shirt?
Indeed. Do you not have a wardrobe department? Claire Byrne had a complete wardrobe department.
You get a wardrobe when you become an established presenter.
Oh, I see.
I was on the radio. You got no wardrobe. You did actually. You got an announce from RTE to get things to keep you dry.
And latter days, I'd say you had someone to iron your shirt for you.
That's down the road, kind of. Those things come in time. But on this
so the rest, the rest, as they say, is history.
Week,
okay.
I was saying to myself, do I have clean clothes to wear? So what they wanted me to do was a slot on the Sunday night programme that, as I said, Fred was presenting. But they wanted me to do a slot on it for about, I think, 10 or 15 minutes or something like that. And with the other sport of the day, they would have a featured match or whatever the case is. And it was then in other sport today type of stuff. And I remember sitting in the studio, and I actually had never sat officially in a television studio before. I'd been in one looking at what was going on, but never actually sat at the desk with the cameras pointed at me, and I'm doing that, why am I here kind of stuff. And I just, after a couple of minutes in the lead up to the programme, in the rehearsals, I noticed that actually Fred was quite nervous and was a little bit kind of edgy in his chair. And Fred was a very experienced, obviously, an excellent presenter at this stage. And I just kind of got this vibe of it. And I said to myself, geez, maybe I should be, but I'm not nervous, you know. So, and as soon as the camera went on, I just relaxed into it. And I just delivered the bulletin. I don't know, was it any good or rubbish or whatever, but I certainly knew I wasn't in any way fazed by it or overwhelmed by it or anything like that.
And that never changed throughout your career?
Yeah, so, no. Well, the thing about it is that this slot in the programme, I did that for a couple of weeks, and I discovered afterwards, the gist of it was, they wanted to see, would I be any good at presenting the Sunday game? So I was put into this scenario to give me the little tester, obviously, and all that kind of thing. And then later on, that was, as I said, in February, I started doing this. And then about April, they said, Sunday game, do you fancy it? And that's how it began.
And difference? Did you find any difference between radio and TV over the years?
The first year, in 1984, was a very, very difficult year for me. And it was very difficult because in those days, there was a lot of strain and even animosity between TV sport and radio sport. And the radio sport people totally objected to me doing this thing because their view of it was, and they weren't necessarily wrong about this, we get these guys in, we train them up in broadcasting, and then TV comes over and just cherry picks what we've got and takes them off us. So I was not flavour of the month in radio when I suggested that I would do a bit of television work or anything like that. And it was a very difficult year because I eventually only got permission to present the Sunday game on condition that I filled all my radio shifts in the week as well. And also in those days,
My question was slightly different.
As well as a Sunday night programme.
Yeah.
So I had two television programmes to do and all my radio shifts, which was a 7-day week and sometimes a 14-hour day.
Okay. But my question was, in technique terms, did you find it different, broadcasting?
It is different. You know this yourself. Television is a different animal to radio. It's a completely, it requires a different approach and a different mindset. But as I said to you a few minutes ago, I found myself comfortable on television. And some people prefer radio, and I love radio as well. You have more control over everything on radio. When you sit in the presenter's chair, like you're doing, most of it lies on your shoulder. And you do not need the people around you. Of course you do, and all that. But you can control so much of it yourself.
All right.
In a television studio, there's so much of it outside your control. It is so technical and everything
absolutely
else involved in it.
Absolutely.
And you're trying to grapple with a lot of it.
With so much we could do it. Quick fire. Describe in one word, Pat Spillane.
Gas.
Joe Brawley.
Lunatic.
Bill O'Hurley.
Good professional. That's two words I know.
Yeah, yeah. Favourite pundit, if you just wanted to stir it up and get a response?
I think, Ivan, favourite pundit and wanting somebody to stir something up are two different things.
Okay, give me one each.
If I wanted somebody to stir things, it was in football, Pat Spillane, in hurling, Gerlach Nann. And the reason, let me just go to the football because this is associated with Joe Brawley, if you like, to some degree. Pat had very strong opinions about things and would deliver for you. But I also could trust Pat because I knew he kind of knew the limitations of himself, and I knew he was self-aware about the way that he would go about things, and obviously still is and all that thing. But my favourite in the football of the presenters would have been Colm O'Rourke, because sometimes with Brawley and Spillane, if things got a little bit out of hand, as they did, obviously people know that, I knew Colm was my go-to man. I knew when I needed help of bringing the whole thing back into some sort of realms of reality, that he was the kind of guy that I could go to.
And did you have a lot of discretion, or did you not have a producer in your ear telling you to cut this out or move on or whatever?
I had a lot of discretion, and yes, I did have the director in my ear and the editor, two different people, and they would be advising me. The guys involved were very good. They would allow you freedom, but within certain terms. I mean, obviously, they had to keep an eye on...
Sure. Best footballer you've ever enjoyed?
Playing-wise?
Yes.
I know that this now is kind of going down the line of playing to the gallery, if you like, but I'm not really playing to the gallery. I would say to you, Pádraig Joyce of Galway. And for several reasons...
Okay, we'll move on to hurling. Move on to your favourite hurler then.
No, wait, let me just finish on Pádraig. Pádraig was a brilliant footballer and is a legend in Galway football, but he's also from the parish of Killawerden at home, where I come from. And Pádraig, by the way, is the current Galway manager.
I know that.
Pádraig definitely. I mean, look.
And I suppose Joe Canning then is your favourite hurler, is he?
Favourite hurler, I would say probably down through the years, Jimmy Barry Murphy, Cork.
Most memorable match?
There were so many brilliant matches down through my career, Ivan. We could be here until Sunday talking about them. But if you ask me to quickly pick one, again, there would be a personal element to this. It was the 1998 football final, which Galway won. And that was because Galway were after winning it for the first time in 32 years. And it meant so much to people in Galway, obviously. There were a couple of people from the parish of Killawerden on that panel, like Pádraig Joyce, for example. And I always try to leave county allegiances out of what you do, because you have to
put that aside.
But on that one occasion, watching Galway win that All-Ireland, there was a huge personal satisfaction.
Any particular low moment other than jigs and reels in 2007?
Why I decided to do jigs and reels, somebody would explain
it was a bone-crushingly low moment.
One of the great
moment,
things about doing jigs and reels that time, it was a one-off, it was a one-night programme. And at least it clarified in my mind, don't ever do Dancing with the Stars.
But any other disasters on air?
No, I've been fortunate. I can't say to you that there were any disasters. Nothing that went so horribly wrong that I went home and put my hands on my head or anything like that. Things will go wrong, you know, and you will have setbacks and all that kind of stuff.
Sorry, describe the GAA in one word.
Do you know what? Genuinely, I mean this. In one word, brilliant.
I thought you were going to say community.
Is there not an element? Community, brilliant as in what they've done with traditional games in a small country and made them what they are. And the community aspect is so right because, again, going back to the village that I grew up in Barna Jarrock, I mean, across the road from our house was the GAA pitch. Wasn't a rugby pitch, wasn't a soccer pitch, wasn't a motor racing track or anything like that. And that's replicated.
Was there not an element with the Sunday game and with you, Michael, that you weren't going to bite the hand that feeds you, that you were really brown-nosing the establishment of the GAA? You never really did a dumpy on it.
I would argue that point with you. And no, I didn't do a dumpy on it, but that's a whole different conversation altogether. I would argue that with you, Ivan, from the point of view that when I came in and took the presenter's chair in 1984, I was 30 years old. And the people that were there before me were very much people, we say in terms of RTE, Mick Dunn, Sean O'Callaghan, Micheál O'Hare, obviously. They felt themselves, and I think I hope I'm right in reflecting on them this way, they very much felt themselves as GAA people and part of the GAA community, like Sean O'Callaghan, for instance, played hurling for Dublin, etc. And they were very, very much connected to the GAA. I wasn't. I came from a different place. Sports-wise, myself, I played soccer growing up. I played a bit of GAA, but I played mostly soccer.
So you think that gave you more freedom?
Yes, I do.
Final thing I have to ask you about, and I wanted to talk about your wife, Anne, who saved your life, but I don't have time. This often happens about wives and spouses. Retirement.
Yes.
Because I'm on the cusp of it, have you reinvented yourself? Did you miss it? Now, I know to some extent there was a health factor. Have you enjoyed your retirement or have you found it a little bit boring?
I have thoroughly enjoyed my retirement. I don't miss it. I enjoyed every minute of being an RTE and of being the presenter of the Sunday game, and I felt very privileged to have that position and what the Sunday game has meant in people's lives and all that kind of thing. But guess what? I was totally happy to step away from it. I didn't feel... First of all, I came to retirement age and I wasn't pushed out the door. I wasn't sat down in the office and said, listen, thanks for everything, but we have this young lady coming in called Joanne and she's taken over from you. It wasn't quite like that. I knew 5 years before I left the Sunday game, I knew when I was going to be leaving. And I knew a year before I left, I knew that Joanne was coming in to take over the chair and all that kind of stuff. So it was an easy transition. It wasn't something sudden that kind of was landed.
But since then, that's a while ago now. I mean, like, since then, how have you punched in your time?
I took a decision. I retired in February of last year, and I took a conscious decision to just take a year out, just chilling, not to be looking to be doing anything or whatever. I think at this stage, Ivan, I'm now getting to the phase, I'm beginning to think to myself, I need to be doing something else with myself here. I think maybe the whole coronavirus thing is that's affecting all of us in every way because there's so little going on around the place. I think we're all getting a bit kind of cabin fever and all that. But I have no doubt, I have no big interest in necessarily doing something in broadcasting. It could be something completely different. But I haven't anything specifically in mind. But I suppose, yeah, there has to come a time when you say to yourself, I think I'll chase another project.
Michael Lister, GAA legend, presenter of the Sunday game for more than three decades. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk through the journey of life and your experiences and giving us those insights. We wish you every future health, happiness in whatever you decide to do. And thank you for joining us on The Hard Shoulder.
Ivan, thank you so much indeed.